Shabbat Shalom and welcome to Kehilat Tenuvah, The Harvest, a Messianic Charismatic congregation in Thornton, Colorado. You're listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. Our goal is to provide, for free, the message of the Torah from a Messianic Judaic perspective. Here's Pastor Mark.
Shabbat Shalom. I'd like to welcome everyone here today. Super excited about the season that we're in. The season of the counting of the Omer, which connects two great Jewish festivals together, two great biblical festivals together. That would be Passover and Shavuot. And Shavuot, of course, is the memorial to the giving of the Torah to the Jewish people becoming the nation of God, Israel, 3,500 plus years ago. And also the giving of the Torah with the outpoured Spirit is seen in Acts chapter 2, where God pours out his Spirit and begins to fulfill all those ancient prophecies that were made not only through Moses, but the later prophets as well. Excited about this, so I'm going to jump into our topic today, Jews, Gentiles, and the chosen people, Israel. Keep in mind that when they came out of Egypt, they came out of slavery. They were slaves in Egypt, and ultimately they would come into royalty in Israel as the people of God, the nation of God, the children of God. So there's 50 days, of course, that transpire between Passover and Shavuot, the first Shavuot, and that's seen in the Exodus itself. So 50 days after they left Egypt, our ancestors then celebrated their first Shavuot. It was there that God offered them chosen people status, a kingdom, a priesthood, and nationhood. And though they said yes to this covenant that God offered them, to this status as his people, they did not keep their end of the bargain. They broke this covenant that was made with them through Moses over and over and over until finally it was destroyed. Later, God divorces them during Isaiah and Jeremiah's time, but he promises through Jeremiah to remarry them later after a period of time and thus renew and restore all the provisions and promises of the covenants lost through their disobedience. So the divorce that was prophesied, yeah, it came and went. But in Messiah, the reconciliation and remarriage came, and restoration has already begun. 2,000 years ago, the restoration of Israel as the people of God, of course, in this remarriage. It has been building ever since. So let me just kind of remind everyone that as we come into the apostolic scriptures, into that common era of the time of Jesus and his disciples, there were tens of thousands of Jewish people who came to faith believing that Jesus was the long-awaited and promised Messiah to come. We'll look at that in a few minutes. Let me just continue on. After this initial influx of Jewish believers in the first century, the Gentiles, their eyes are opened, and they too begin to rally around this tremendous persona, Jesus of Nazareth, and they believe that he too was the Messiah. They believed that he was their hope and their redemption. And so the Gentiles, they come bursting in as well and begin to fill up, so to speak, this what Paul would call the commonwealth of Israel through faith in Messiah. So today, the Gentiles have a remarkable opportunity to join in this return to God among Jewish believers for the last 2,000 years. They get to join in this return to God among Jewish believers through faith in the Messiah, Yeshua, son of David. So let's jump back and begin to look at this first Shavuot. It's found all the way back in Exodus chapter 19, verses 1 to 9. This is when the descendants of Jacob came out of Egypt and began to make their way to Sinai. Keep in mind that there was a mixed multitude, a very large number of Gentiles who came out of Egypt with them and joined them in that Exodus. So Exodus 19, 1 through 9. In the third month, which is Sivan, in the third month after the sons of Israel gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim, They came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. Moses went up to God, and the Lord called him from the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the sons of Israel, You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all the words which the Lord had commanded them. All the people answered together and said, All that the Lord has spoken we will do. And Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, Behold, I will come to you in a thick cloud, so that the people may hear when I speak with you and may also believe in you forever. Then Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. This is really such a fascinating passage of this covenant that God makes with the descendants of Jacob. Note well that their excitement, too, was at an all-time high. They said to the Lord, All that you say we will do. So in essence, they became at that point formally a holy nation, a nation under God. They became his own possession. If you will, if you cast this in the metaphor of a marriage, they became the wife at this point. They were the chosen, the beloved, the betrothed, the wife of God. And it is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful story, other than the fact that Israel did not keep the covenant, but rather broke it. Over and over and over. It's on the heels of this event that we have the golden calf incident. And then later we see another great breach of the covenant at Baal of Peor. And we see this not only in those two instances, but many times over down through the corridor of time where Israel continues to break covenant with God. And God, of course, disciplines his people. Ultimately through a separation, and then finally in divorce. Isaiah 50 in verse 1 says this, Where is the certificate of divorce by which I have sent your mother away? Or to whom of my creditors did I sell you? Behold, you were sold for your iniquities and for your transgressions. Your mother was sent away. Now that's pretty clear. In fact, I've had much dialogue with Messianic Jewish leaders concerning this idea of God divorcing his people. And it is staggering in its ramifications. Let me go to another passage. Jeremiah 3, 6 through 8. Then the Lord said to me in the days of Josiah the king, Have you seen what faithless Israel did? She went up on every high hill and under every green tree, and she was a harlot there. I thought, After she has done all these things, she will return to me. But she did not return, and her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And I saw that for all the adulteries of faithless Israel, I had sent her away and given her a writ of divorce. Now I want us to stop and think about that. Both Isaiah and Jeremiah prophesying here, God speaking through them, makes it very clear that God had divorced his people Israel. He sent his wife away. And not only did he send her away, but he sent her away with a writ of divorce, a written document explaining that or declaring that. And the prophets probably wrote that out for the people of Israel on behalf of God. The prophets were forever proclaiming and demonstrating whatever it was that the Lord was trying to communicate. Not only would they proclaim it, they would then do things to illustrate or to by way of dramatic expression, make that pointed and real. And so there are commentators that have suggested that both Jeremiah and Isaiah probably wrote that out and signed it on behalf of God as a representative of God, and gave that to the leadership of Israel. And I think it's very, very clear that God had sent his people away with a writ of divorce. Now, that is horrifying in so many different ways. But the good news is that the prophet Jeremiah, even though he prophesied that Israel would be put away through a writ of divorce, and that God would also, in mercy and great compassion, later remarry Israel, that he would, through a new covenant, remarry her and restore to her all that was lost through her disobedience. So let's look at the promise of the new covenant, i.e. the remarriage, under better terms. Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, although I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. They will not teach again each man his neighbor, and each man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord. And I will forgive their iniquity, and their sin I will remember no more. This is the prophesied new covenant, and it's a powerful covenant. It's a beautiful covenant. The first covenant had all kinds of problems, not within the covenant itself, but the people. The people were not responsive. The people did not keep the covenant. So this new covenant that God makes, it's different in the sense that the new covenant is going to be something that he does within them, that he does through a recreation, if you will, of their hearts. And Jeremiah prophesies it. And of course, we find the fulfillment of that in Messiah. And so if we'll jump forward to the apostolic scriptures, I just want to jump into the last Passover Seder that the Messiah, Yeshua, has with his disciples. And it's during that evening on which he's going to be betrayed that he, in this Seder, basically states that he's establishing that long-awaited new covenant, that he will ratify it with his own blood and establish it. And this remarriage will be offered, of course, to Israel once again, that it's in the days of Messiah that what was prophesied through Jeremiah would come to pass. So in Luke 22:20, and you can catch the fuller chapter at a later time, go back and read it, but I'm just going to grab that verse that specifically, explicitly states it. Luke 22:20. And in the same way, he, Yeshua, took the cup after they had eaten, saying, This cup, which is poured out for you, is the new covenant in my blood. So Yeshua here is explaining and revealing to them that he's about to ratify the new covenant in what's going to transpire in the next 24 hours, his crucifixion on the cross. That as the Lamb of God, he'll pour out his blood, symbolized in the third cup, the cup of redemption in the Seder, symbolized there by the wine. And he's saying that I'm pouring out my life as an atonement for you, and that through my poured out life in the blood, contained in the blood, you will be forgiven. And in that forgiveness, God will remarry you. And in that remarriage, restoration will come. It's beautiful and powerful beyond words. Now, after his crucifixion, he was resurrected. And in that resurrection, he was vindicated. Everything that he said was true. He is the Son of God, the Lamb of God. He is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. He's the long-awaited Messiah who brought and inaugurated the kingdom of God on earth. And now he's ascended on high, sitting at the right hand of God, ruling and reigning over everything. Now the result of this is that many, many Jewish people came to faith in him. Let me read this for you. It's Acts chapter 21, verses 17 through 20. After we arrived in Jerusalem, this is Paul speaking. Paul has come to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the center of Messianic Judaism. It's the center of this movement of Jesus, the Nazarene movement. And James the Just, the half-brother of Jesus, is presiding as the president of what F.F. Bruce will call a Messianic Sanhedrin. And so Paul's come all the way from where he's been working as a missionary, and he's bringing this great news of all that God is doing among the Gentiles in the diaspora. And of course, he meets James the Just, and he meets also the elders of Jerusalem as they gather together, and Paul shares with them. This is how the story unfolds. Verse 18. And the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. After he had greeted them, he began to relate one by one things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they began glorifying God. These James the Just, the elders, they were amazed at the response of the Gentiles to this message of who Jesus is, who he, his death, his resurrection, what he accomplished through all of that. And they were just rejoicing in this open arms towards Yeshua the Messiah among the Gentiles. But notice what they say. James said to him, Paul, you see, this is verse 20, you see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law. These are what we refer to today as Messianic Jews. In the first century, they would have been considered Nazarenes, the followers of Jesus of Nazareth, the sect of the Nazarenes. And what qualifies them, you know, when we say Messianic Jew, what qualifies them as such is the fact that they believed, as Jews, they believed that Jesus is the Messiah, and they're also zealous for the Torah. They're zealous for the law. Now, in Stern's commentary, the Jewish New Testament commentary, he has some quotes from some historians and some authorities on what the population was in Jerusalem in the Common Era, in the time of Jesus. And they put the number of the Jewish people in Jerusalem at about 40,000 in the year 4 BCE, and also at about 80,000 in 66 CE. That would be just right when the crisis is breaking out with Rome and culminating in 70 AD, of course, in the tragedy of 70 AD. But that number rises to about 80,000 Jews in Jerusalem at about 66 CE. Now, I want you to think about that, that number of Jews in Jerusalem. And think about what I just read, how many thousands there are among the Jews who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law. The context is James the Just with Paul and the elders in Jerusalem. So this word, many thousands, it's the word myriad in the Greek. We get the English word myriad from that word. And in the Greek, it's actually a term that means strictly 10,000. It's a number, 10,000. And in the plural, it means 20,000 plus. 20,000 plus. And so what James is saying here is there's 20,000 plus Jews who believe that Jesus is the Messiah, and they're all zealous for the law. That's a pretty big number. Think about that. That the minimum number of Messianic Jews in Jerusalem at around that time period would have been 20,000 plus. That's approximately, roughly, one quarter of the Jewish population. That is an amazing and remarkable healthy minority within Jerusalem among Jews who believe that Jesus is the Messiah. That sect of the Nazarenes is represented today in what we call the Messianic Jewish movement, believing Jews who are zealous for the Torah. Now, let me jump back a little bit and talk some more about the Gentiles and where they fit in. Paul calls it the mystery of the gospel. And the mystery of the gospel is that the Gentiles as Gentiles are being brought into Israel and the covenants of promise through faith in the Messiah. You can get a book. It's called actually Grafted In by F-F-O-Z. Grafted In, F-F-O-Z. An amazing look at the mystery of the gospel. We encourage you to get that book. We have it in our offices. If you'd like to get it there as well, you can get it on Amazon or you can go to ffoz.org and get that book. Okay, so we Gentiles now have the remarkable opportunity to join in this return to God and His holy law among Jewish people through faith in Messiah Yeshua. There are more Messianic Jews today than any other time in history. The rise of believing Jews is higher in our day than it's ever been in any other time in history, including the great revival of the apostolic era in that first 100 years of Messianic Judaism. Now, what about the Gentiles? Well, the Gentiles, yeah, they're forcing their way into this movement. And I use that word forcing their way in on purpose. Why? Well, the Messianic Jewish movement has not been very accommodating to the Gentiles coming in. I mean, if you've been around long enough and you're a Gentile, you know that. That's just true. But I want to say to Messianic Jewish leaders everywhere, and I've talked to numerous Messianic Jewish leaders over the last 30 years, I want to just say to Messianic Jewish leaders, and I want to say it with as much force as I can say it. Let my people in. Let my people in. I started saying this years ago in dialogue with Messianic Jewish leaders who have taken this position that the Gentiles are, you know, not quite welcome in this movement. You know what? I've learned to say, look, it's time to let the Gentiles in. And I've been told on more than one occasion, who are you to tell us to let the Gentiles in? Who are you? And specifically, what they referred to in this comment about who are you is sometimes who are you ethnically to tell us? Or at other times, they're saying, what are your credentials? And so, you know what? I've said this before. I'm going to say it again. I'll tell you who I am. I am a voice of one crying in the wilderness. Let the Gentiles as Gentiles in. And I want you to think about that. The way that the Gentiles have been treated in the Messianic Jewish movement has to change. It's not right. It's created a lot of problems along the way. And it's time that Messianic Jewish leaders embrace Gentiles as full brothers and sisters in Messiah. Now, my understanding of Gentiles as Gentiles coming in, my understanding of this issue and my authority on this issue, it doesn't reside in a degree from a seminary, but from heaven itself. And therefore, I declare to Messianic Jewish leaders and to institutions what I sense strongly our Father saying. And this is it. I sense the Father saying, in the name of heaven, let the Gentiles I have chosen join into and with those I have previously chosen as my people. A popular phrase found in one of the epistles to the Jews first. And also to the Gentiles, that this whole message of the salvation of God, the redemption of God, is to the Jew first, but it's also to the Gentiles. We see this in the covenant promises made to Abraham, that he would bless Abraham, he would bless his descendants, that they would become a mighty, mighty, mighty people. But through them, he would also bless all of the Gentiles. To the Jew first, and also to the Gentiles. There are some in the Messianic Jewish movement that are trying to use conversion policies to help Gentiles become Jewish first so they can be accepted in this movement. I just think it's crazy. It's mashugana. I want to say, quit trying to convert the Gentiles into being Jews before accepting them as your brothers and sisters. For you too were once not a people. God says, I found you and adopted you as my own. That's right. You were once not a people. You're the people of God because he adopted you. He adopted the Jewish people first, but he wasn't done adopting. That's the mystery of the gospel. He wasn't done in this work of adopting people as his own. And Gentiles, you know, quit trying to convert and become Jewish so as to be accepted. That's ridiculous. It's ludicrous. Do you actually think that you can change your ethnic status through a ritual? And what's the motivation so you can be accepted? See, in Messiah, God has already chosen you, accepted you, and adopted you into his family, making you one with the Jewish people. Those people that he previously has chosen and adopted. You see, in Messiah, both people groups have become one new humanity. So that being ethnically Jewish or ethnically Gentile is not the most important thing anymore, but rather keeping his commandments and his ways. That's what matters most at this point in redemptive history. Let me shift gears a little bit. Jump into 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. He's speaking primarily to a Gentile audience. These are the very promises, of course, that have come to the Jewish people first. And then through them, they're going on to the Gentiles. And God is adding Gentiles to the number of Jewish believers. He's adding Gentiles to the commonwealth of Israel. He's grafting Gentile olive branches, if you will, into a Jewish olive tree. So let me just read this for you. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. It begins in verse 9. Speaking to, by and large, a Gentile believing audience. But you are a chosen race. Sound familiar? Let me start again. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. For you once were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. That paradigm, that process, that plan was first given to the Jewish people. That's how they became the people of God. Through adoption, he embraced them by grace and made them his own. And now he's adding to his own the Gentiles who believe in Messiah. He's adding to those already gathered the Gentiles, just as he promised Abraham. And so to the Gentiles, I want you to understand that you were once not a people, but now, just like the Jewish people, now you also have received mercy. You also are being added to the people of God. You also are chosen in Messiah and become part of this chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. He's expanding the tent pegs of Israel, and he's bringing in the Gentiles. It's an amazing plan of redemption. Jews and Gentiles becoming one in Messiah. So, to the Gentiles, three PowerPoints in closing. Number one, from this passage, number one, identity determines destiny. Your identity determines your destiny. How you view yourself, your perception of who you are, is going to determine your destiny. Think about this. You, as a Gentile, are accepted in Messiah. You are adopted by God and become a child of God. And you are equally part of Israel, the chosen people of God. Equally a part of Israel as the Jew who believes is. You're participating equally in the chosen race, the royal priesthood, and the holy nation being possessed by God himself. To the Jew first, but also to you. And number two, the second PowerPoint, identity determines purpose and meaning. Your identity will predispose you to purpose and meaning. You are the heralds, the ambassadors, announcing and teaching the excellencies of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. You join in with a mighty throng of believing Jews in becoming ambassadors to announce and teach the excellencies of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And number three, God determines identity. You don't. You can't even change identity. Only God can do that. God determines identity. He chose us, and he called us, and he freed us from the tyranny of sin, shame, and misery. And he adopted us and made us a kingdom, a royal priesthood, and a holy nation unto him. To the Jew first, and also to the Gentile. So in closing, I just want to make this application. Seize your identity as being part of Israel, the chosen people of God. Seize your identity. You too are part of the chosen people, Israel. Learn it. Meditate on it. Embrace it. Be it. Walk it out. It is your heritage. It's your inheritance. And it's your destiny. Seize it, or you'll miss it altogether. Grab hold of it. It's yours. Run with it. Enjoy it. Live it. Be it. It's who you are in Messiah. And never, ever, ever forget, it's to the Jew first, but also to the Gentile. Shabbat shalom.
Yahweh spoke to Moses saying, speak to Aaron and his sons saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, may Yahweh bless you and keep you. May Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And we add, in the name of Yeshua, our Messiah, the Prince of Peace, so you shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them. Yivarech Adonai ve'yishmerecha. Yaher Adonai panav alecha ve'yihunecha. Yisa Adonai panav alecha. Ve'asemlecha shalom. Shabbat shalom.
You've been listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. We hope you have found this teaching relevant and challenging for your life. If you are in the Metro Denver area, please join us on Shabbat. Service starts at 1 p.m. and ends at 3 p.m. Kehilat Tenuva is located at 8891 Pose Boulevard in Thornton, Colorado, just a few miles north of downtown Denver. For more information, please visit www.graftedin.com. That's www.graftedin.com. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 29993, Thornton, Colorado, 80229. For inquiries, please call 303-761-9948 or email info@graftedin.com. Thank you for listening to the Shabbat message. Shabbat shalom and Shavua tov. Shabbat.